Welcome to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM, the show that brings you in-depth coverage of local, regional, and national environmental issues. For podcasts of this show and all others, you can go to the Earth Matters page on the Gila Members Community Radio website. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's show, and I'm the executive director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, which is a local nonprofit working to protect the Gila watershed through advocacy, education, and restoration. Joining me in the studio today are two guests from Las Cruces, Joanna Bencomo of New Mexico Cafe, which is short for Comunidades en Acción y de Fe, and Kevin Bixby from the Southwest Environmental Center, or SWEC for short. We'll be discussing border issues, and there's a lot of those, and how the current administration's policies impact people, the land, and wildlife. Earth Matters, as you know, if you're a listener, you know that we usually focus on conservation issues, but more often than not, conservation and social justice issues are two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. This is certainly the case with the U.S.-Mexico border. Welcome, Joanna and Kevin.
Thank you, Donna. You. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so excited to be here.
So we have a lot to talk about today, so I'm just going to jump right in here. And because I have two guests, we're kind of going to go back and forth with some of the questions. So I'd like to start today's show with you, Joanna. Many Americans have been speaking up since Trump's inauguration about various policies, and one of the things that people have commented on most often is the repeal of the Affordable Care Act that will change our country's future. Mm-hmm. But when I heard you speak at a progressive summit meeting in Las Cruces in mid-July, you said that one of the first things Trump did upon taking office was to start deporting immigrants. So here we're not talking about some horrible thing that he's going to do in the future, but we're talking about something that's happening right now in our communities. And I wonder if you can talk about what Trump did right away at the start of his presidency.
Yeah, thanks, Donna. Well, first, let me say thanks for having us. I'm super excited to be here and to be in Silver City. I really love Silver City. So I think part of what you heard me say at the Progressive Summit a few weeks ago was that a lot of the changes we see coming out of this administration are sort of being talked about as upcoming, right? Particularly around healthcare or even our public lands and things that are sort of looming that we kind of expect and that people have been pushing back and resisting. Unfortunately, that's not the same for the issue of immigration. Immediately after taking office, there were a couple of executive orders. So executive orders, right, require absolutely no approval from Congress for the president to take action. And one of these, and a couple of these really were around immigration, essentially ordering the Department of Homeland Security to make drastic changes in the way that enforcement is conducted in the interior of the country. Among many of those things, I think some of the biggest, most drastic changes were who is at priority for deportation. So in the previous administration, there's about 3.4 million people at priority for deportation out of 11 million undocumented Americans due to some sort of criminal history record or something like that. The Trump administration essentially got rid of that and said that 11 million people are at priority for deportation. So 11 million undocumented folks, regardless of whether you have a criminal background or not, regardless of whether you have children born in the United States or not, of how many decades you've given to this country, you could be at priority for deportation. He called for the expansion of ICE and Border Patrol agencies.
And ICE is?
So, yes, call me out on that. I have a lot of those. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which essentially is mostly in the interior of the United States and in charge of enforcing federal immigration law. And then Border Patrol mostly resides on the U.S.-Mexico border, enforcing the border. A couple other things that changed pretty much immediately, and when I say immediately, I mean like 5 days into his presidency. He made it a lot easier to deport immigrants without due process, which was already sort of something that was easy to do anyway, and limited prosecutorial discretion, which essentially allows ICE agents to have discretion on who they can grant stays of removal or slow down deportations. That's essentially gone now. And then also he threatened to take away critical funding for cities that refused to essentially coordinate with ICE and Border Patrol agencies.
So those are what we call sanctuary cities?
Yeah, sanctuary cities is what most commonly would be heard of. I think for some reason that became some sort of negative connotation. But really, sanctuary cities are just cities and jurisdictions that prioritize community safety over enforcing federal immigration law and forcing local police departments to do that and to threaten the relationship that they have with communities.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like police departments already have enough to do without taking
That's right.
on this extra task. And then there's the whole thing of people being afraid to call the
That's
police.
That's right. When we talk about public safety, that's really the conversation we should be having, right?
Yeah.
Undocumented communities being afraid to call local law enforcement when they feel unsafe, right? And the more that local law enforcement start working with federal immigration agencies, the more that drift will get larger and larger.
So when Barack Obama was elected president, I should say after he was elected president, I heard a lot of talk and saw articles about the U.S. being a post-racial society, which at the time I thought was really delusional. And in the last few weeks, I mean, since that white supremacist rally and the murder at Charlottesville and its aftermath, which was pretty disgraceful, I think it's really hard for people now to deny that race is really still a very big issue in this country. But usually when we talk about racial issues, we really are mostly talking about black. It's a kind of a black and white issue, right?
Yeah.
Like literally. So I want to ask you, Joanna, how does racism affect Trump's immigration and border policies?
Yeah, well, let me say actually first to the point of Charlottesville that I think that people of color in this country have been talking about the over and sort of the implicit racism that exists in our country for a really long time. And mm-hmm. I feel like what happened in Charlottesville sort of shocked a lot of people. But a lot of communities of color were like, honestly, this was just something that was sort of the breaking point that we've been experiencing implicit forms of racism for such a long time that this overtness was sort of almost expected, mm-hmm. To be honest. And it's sad, right? But to the point of race in this country around immigration, I think inherently immigration law in this country has always been racist. It favors white immigrants over immigrants of color. And I think we see that particularly now on who is getting deported, right? And I think particularly it's immigrants of color that are being targeted, whether it's that they're from Latin America, American countries, or Middle Eastern countries, right? We see since President Trump took office that 108 immigrants per day are being deported.
Wow.
And that's 108 people with no criminal record or anything like that, right? And I would say primarily they are immigrants of color. And I think there's people like Bannon or Jeff Sessions that are blowing a lot of dog whistles around border communities and around immigrants. And that's such a dog whistle for white supremacy, frankly. And so
Wait, he said that immigrants have democracy in their DNA?
That a lot of, like, we can't allow all these immigrants to come into the country because so many don't have democracy.
Oh, like he does, right?
Right.
So,
sorry.
Yeah, so anyway, and then Jeff Sessions, right, comes to our border community and says that it's ground zero and says these truly awful things when in reality I look at our border community and the border community is Kevin and leaders like Viviana, who, right, like so many of our people who represent the border community and is so not like that. And I think now more than ever, particularly because of what's happening in our country and what happened in Charlottesville and continues to happen in many cities, communities of color, I think, really need to no longer isolate, right? And movements can no longer isolate, particularly in social justice.
So. Yeah, we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show, too. You know, kind of working with other groups, which we need to do. Since last week when I started preparing for this show, there's been a couple of new developments. Like, things are happening so quickly now
yeah.
that it's really hard to keep up.
It really is.
Bad things, for the most part, although some good has come out of it. So on August 25th, that was Friday as we record this show, the country was really focused a lot on Hurricane Harvey. I mean,
right.
that's a big deal, still ongoing.
Right.
And at that time, President Trump took advantage of that moment to pardon Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was convicted of what, criminal contempt, for refusing to follow a court order to stop racial profiling. Can you tell us about this, Joanna?
Yeah, Sheriff Arpaio has sort of been this symbol of anti-immigration. You know, community organizers and colleagues in Arizona worked tirelessly last year to really turn out the vote, and people in Phoenix and that county spoke, right, and finally voted him out. And that was such a huge victory for the residents of that community. And honestly, it felt like for immigrants across the country. And so when you have President Trump pardoning somebody like him who's so disgraceful, who's found guilty of racially profiling Latinos, and not only that, but running some of the worst, a tent city, right, where immigrants were being detained in tents in 120 degree weather in Phoenix. Right. Just awful, awful things happened in that place. And for him to pardon someone that horrible felt like a huge slap to the face, honestly, particularly for people in Arizona, but honestly for Latinos and immigrants across the country. And I think doing it in the middle of one of the worst natural disasters we've seen just feels really evil. And even us expecting an announcement on DACA around this time just feels just evil at the core.
Yeah, evil's a good word to describe what's going on. I mean, it's like he's taken the gloves off, you know, or I guess we could say he's taken the white sheets off, you know. It's like you don't even have to wear your sheet anymore, you know, if you're going to go out there and be a white supremacist. So, yeah, and he has just really given a lot of legitimacy to that issue now. And you just mentioned DACA, and that was my next question for you. So DACA, another acronym, is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. I wonder if you could talk about this program briefly, Joanna, and talk about what its destruction would mean.
Oh, my goodness. So DACA, like you said, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, was an executive order that came from President Obama 2012, after Dreamers, who have been deemed Dreamers because of the Dream Act and many of the reasons, but essentially are young kids or young adults that were brought to the United States at a very young age and were undocumented. And after the Dream Act failed a couple of times, President Obama took executive order action and granted them temporary relief from deportation and a work permit, given that you met certain requirements, right? But a lot of young people benefited from DACA and are going to school, have jobs, are supporting their families, you know, have been contributing to the economy of New Mexico and the country. So taking this away, about almost 1 million young people benefited from DACA. So taking this away means that 1 million people would now be deportable, would not be sought after for deportations.
And these are people, a lot of these young people don't know any other country, right? I mean, they grew up here from when they were little bitty kids. And
Small children that their main language now is Spanglish if they grew up on the border, right? But that don't know any other home than the United States, and that could not imagine their lives, honestly, anywhere else.
And they're just being labeled as criminals now just because their parents brought them here as children.
That's right. And even their parents are being labeled as criminals, right, when all their parents wanted was an opportunity for their kids to do exactly what they're doing right now that they have DACA, go to school and pursue education and have a job and build a life. So it's going to be, honestly, it's going to be pretty sad and devastating news. So I'm not looking forward to that.
Right. We can talk about that a little bit more after we take this short break. Please stay with us. I'm talking with Joanna Bencomo and Kevin Bixby about border issues. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's program. And I'm talking with Kevin Bixby and Joanna Bencomo about issues on the U.S.-Mexico border. They're both from Las Cruces, so this is a more pertinent issue down there because they're a little closer to the border. Kevin, I want to turn now to a really visual image, probably what most people think of when they think of the U.S.-Mexico border. And, of course, it's the infamous border wall. Can you tell us about the border wall, Kevin, how many miles of border the U.S. shares with Mexico? And how much of this wall is currently in place?
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show, Donna. It's great to be back in Silver City and on the show.
Currently, there are about 650 miles of some sort of barrier along the U.S.-Mexican border, and that's about a third of the total, almost 2,000-mile-long border between the U.S. and Mexico. So of those 653 miles of existing barrier, about 300 miles of those are vehicle barriers, which are designed to stop, obviously, the passage of vehicles, but they're fairly easy for humans and most wildlife animals to negotiate.
Okay.
Not all. Pronghorn have a hard time with those, crossing those. And then of the remainder, there are about 350 miles of what's called pedestrian fencing. And this is the really impenetrable type of metal barrier that is so difficult. It's frankly impossible for most wildlife species to cross.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we are most concerned about because of the impacts it's already having on wildlife in the border region. And if it's expanded, it's going to be even more of a problem.
Are there other ecological impacts besides wildlife not being able to cross easily?
Oh, yeah. The U.S.-Mexican border crosses through some very wild areas, public lands, National Wildlife Refuge, national monuments, some really important areas biologically. These are some of the most biologically rich areas of the United States. It's here in New Mexico and Arizona, we have the coming together of four major ecoregions, and there's a lot of biodiversity. And down in the South Valley, the lower Rio Grande Valley of South Texas, it's also a very important biological area. But some of the other impacts, besides blocking the passage of wildlife, these barriers disrupt the drainage off the land. So we've seen mm-hmm. some major flooding happen in Douglas and Nogales. And we've seen just the impact of constructing the border. We see vegetation cleared. And then the associated activities, you know, the vehicles, the stadium lights, high-intensity lights that light up at night, the noise, it's all very disruptive for wildlife.
Yeah. And I understand that the Department of Homeland Security has the authority to waive environmental laws when they're building walls or other structures at the border. So what kind of laws are we talking about here? And what are the consequences of the Department of Homeland Security not having to follow the laws that other federal agencies are required to abide by?
Right. So in the name of making the border, which is portrayed as this crazy out-of-control area that's where, you know, hordes of people and drug traffickers are crossing over at will, this area of lawlessness, in the name of bringing law and order to this region, ironically, the federal government has made it a lawless region because in 2005, Congress gave the Department of Homeland Security the authority to waive any law, federal, state, local. It deemed, the secretary deemed necessary to construct the wall and border security infrastructure. And Homeland Security has used that waiver to build all the existing 650-odd miles of barriers that exist today. And some of the laws that have been waived include the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, the Clean Air Act, Archaeological Resources Protection Act, on and on. The Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the American Indian Religious Freedom Act.
Oh, my goodness.
So these have all been waived in the name of national security to build this wall. And the result is we normally when the feds come in and do a big project, they have to do an environmental assessment of the potential impacts. And they have to look at alternatives to the project that they are proposing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives the public a sense of, you know, what's going to be the benefits and cost, including environmental impacts. But that hasn't been done for the border wall. So we don't know exactly what the impacts have been on wildlife. We don't know what the impacts have been on the environment, except post-construction. We have seen them.
So I think you're referring to the National Environmental Policy Act, often just shortened to NEPA. People hear about NEPA a lot.
Right, yeah.
And that also has a requirement for people to be able to give input.
Right.
And so none of that's happening.
That's all been waived with a wave of the secretary's hand.
Right.
And like I said before, we have made the border a lawless region in building this wall.
Yes. And we haven't even talked about the human impacts of that yet. You know, all the abuse of immigrants, because, I mean, some of it personally witnessed. The federal budget for fiscal year 2018, which starts on October 1st, include a $1.6 billion, that's billion with a B, down payment for the border wall. And Kevin, I read recently that President Trump is threatening a government shutdown if Congress doesn't approve this funding for his pet project, the border wall. Can you talk about this?
You mean the border wall that Mexico was going to pay for?
No. Well,
now he's going to shut down the U.S. federal government?
The guy's a bit delusional about that.
If the U.S. taxpayers don't pay for his wall?
And that's what he's saying. If Congress doesn't approve his
right.
$1.6 billion.
Yeah, so budget battle over this.
Mm-hmm.
The Dems in the Senate are our only hope for stopping this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they are pretty united in saying they will not fund construction of the border wall.
Mm-hmm.
But with the threat of shutting down the government, there is tremendous pressure on those senators now to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
So in exchange for no wall, what are they going to have to give up?
Right.
DACA?
Mm-hmm.
More Border Patrol agents? You know, there's going to be a lot of pressure, which is why we are focused so much right now working with our coalition partners like CAFE and the ACLU to send a clear message to our representatives in Congress, particularly our senators, not to cave. No wall, no boots, no beds.
That was one of my questions. I've heard you guys say that before, no walls, no boots, no beds. What, can you explain that for people,
yeah,
for our
so
listeners?
No boots, obviously. Well, not obviously, but that means no more additional Border Patrol agents or ICE agents hired. Customs and Border Patrol is the largest law enforcement agency in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Bigger than all the others combined.
18,000 agents on the U.S.-Mexico border.
We don't need more Border Patrol agents. Perhaps they can be, you know, redeployed in different ways, but not. We don't need more. We don't need more detention facilities. That's the beds part.
Okay.
We're already locking up huge numbers.
Mm-hmm.
This is all for show. It's just to appeal to Trump's base, and it's not needed, and we're fighting back. And we're standing shoulder to shoulder with our partners and saying no more. It's all part of the militarization of the border that our borderlands communities are tired of.
Yes, exactly. So, Kevin, I understand that you recently traveled to the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge in South Texas, and I wonder if you can tell our listeners a little bit about this area and then tell us what you guys were doing down there.
We went down to the lower Rio Grande Valley of Texas, down in to the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge, because this is where we think the next round of border wall construction is going to take place.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the contractors for DHS have been doing soil testing down there in anticipation and preparation for construction. And, you know, frankly, this is where we intend to draw a line in the sand. Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge is one of the most special places in the country in terms of wildlife. It's a major birding destination. Almost 400 species of birds can be found down there. It brings in millions of dollars to the local community from wildlife viewing, particularly birding. It's home to endangered species like ocelots, which is a small spotted cat, and jaguarundis, which is another small cat, no spots. And these are both endangered in the United States, but this is where they are found. It's in South Texas, and in particular in this National Wildlife Refuge. It's a crown jewel mm-hmm. of our National Wildlife Refuge system. And the reason why it is being targeted for wall construction is because it's federal land, and the federal government will not have to condemn private land as it would in most of Texas along the border.
Okay. And have they already started working down there? I thought they were, like, taking measurements or doing something already down there?
They have been doing soil testing.
Soil testing, okay.
Yeah, they haven't actually started construction, but they could at any time. DHS claims that it has the funding, existing funding. It doesn't need the new budget appropriations bill to get the money. It has existing funding to do more wall construction down there.
Okay.
And, you know, it's ridiculous. When you're down there, you can see how useless this wall is. There are gaps in the wall. The refuge sits in the middle of a 10-mile gap. So for 10 miles, there is no wall. DHS, they have let it be known that they intend to build 3 miles of wall because that's as much as they can in the National Wildlife Refuge. There will still be these huge gaps on either side. You know why I think they're doing it? Besides the fact that it's federal land, is they want to say, screw you, to people that care about the wildlife along the border,
mm-hmm.
environment, to the community. The community is opposed to this as well down
mm-hmm.
there.
Right. Well, I remember when Janet Napolitano was the head of the Department of Homeland Security, and she said something like, show me a 50-foot wall, and I'll show you a 51-foot ladder. But you're saying that here they don't even need a ladder. They can just go around the edge of the wall. So it's completely useless.
Humans can. Wildlife, not so much. And one of the big problems down there is they cannot, because of the treaty with Mexico, they cannot build a structure in the floodplain. So they're building it on top of these existing levees. The flood control levees now are no barrier for wildlife. Wildlife can scramble up. If there's a flood that comes from the riverside, which happens, it may be happening now, wildlife can get away. They can climb up and go to the other side of the levee. But they're proposing to build the fence, the wall, on top of these levees, and to make the riverside of the levee a vertical concrete wall. If there's a flood, animals will drown. That's the long and short of it.
Yeah, okay. So we're going to be right back after this short break to continue our discussion about border issues with Kevin Bixby and Joanna Bencomo. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, your host for today's program, and I'm talking with Kevin Bixby and Joanna Bencomo about issues on the U.S.-Mexico border. There's so much to talk about that we might not get through all of these issues by the end of the show. So I want to go back to something that we were talking about in the last segment of the show, which was the, what is the quote, you guys have no boots?
No boots, no beds, no wall.
Thank you. So let's talk about the beds part. Because I think this is not well known, that there are these things called immigration detention quotas. Can you tell us what that means, Joanna?
Yeah, so back in 2009, well, actually, I will say that in the last decade, there's been a trend in essentially criminalizing the American dream. And we're seeing harsher and harsher immigration laws as opposed to fair and just immigration reform, policy supporting immigrants. One of those very anti-immigrant policies was in 2009, Congress essentially told the Department of Homeland Security that there was this detention bed mandate or a bed quota, mandating that ICE needed to fill 34,000 beds per night every day of immigrants in detention centers. Honestly, it's one of the most horrendous things that we've seen in a long time and around the world. And honestly, the bed quota, the 34,000 bed quota is not even irrelevant because I believe there's about 38,000 immigrants in detention per day in our country right now.
In detention centers across the country?
Whether they're ICE facilities and or most commonly then ICE or DHS will then contract out to private prison groups like GEO Group or Core Civic, formerly known as CCA. And the private prison industry is booming, and it's no surprise as to why we don't have immigration reform when this private prison industry is you know going to Congress and telling them to enact tougher and harsher immigration laws that lock up immigrants for profit, right? And the Department of Justice as well uses private facilities to house inmates, and people of color predominantly are affected, and so essentially we're worth more on a bed than we are living our lives with our families free.
Yeah.
That's right.
So these privately run detention centers are basically profiting off of human misery.
We are profiting off taking the liberty of humans. That's right.
And children. Innocent, absolutely innocent little bitty kids.
Yes, there are detention centers. There are family detention centers where you will often see young mothers with babies and young children.
Wow. I just find that absolutely shocking, and I didn't think I could really be shocked anymore by what's going on.
But. And so the budget, the reason we say no beds in our logo or our hashtag is because President Trump has asked for this next budget to increase the bed quota to 44,000.
So 35,000 or 34,000 wasn't enough.
We need
to make more money.
That's right.
So the private prison industry is the definition of evil in my view.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I think there were fewer incarcerations for drug offenses, and they saw their profits diminishing. So they saw an opportunity with beefing up immigration detentions
right.
and
right.
Trump.
Exactly. But, I mean, that issue has kind of been popularized in the last few years, especially like with Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim
that's
Crow.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And then, oh, well, so we have to make up for that now. And yeah. Let's let immigrants be the new criminals.
That's exactly right. And
criminals.
The day after the election this last year, CCA Core Civic saw its stocks skyrocketed the day mm-hmm. after. You know, yeah. people knew that immigrants are going to make business for somebody. And
right.
So I'm a person of faith, and the only way I can describe the private prison industry is sinful. It's
yeah.
truly, truly sinful.
Yes, it is. So before the break, we were talking about the ecological impacts of the border wall, and Kevin Bixby was telling us about that. Joanna, I wanted to ask you, what are some of the social impacts of the border
yeah.
wall?
So I think it's important to acknowledge that most people crossing the border, coming to the United States unlawfully, I guess you could say, actually cross with visas that they overstay. I would say like 75% mm-hmm. of people who are here, probably. That's how I came to the United States, with a visa. And more we're seeing that actually the Mexican migration is a negative trend. There are more Mexicans leaving the United States than there are coming in. So I think, like Kevin said, right, it's like sort of giving a huge middle finger. Can I say that on the radio?
I just did.
I'm sorry. to environmentalists, right? saying like this public land, you know what? We're going to use it for whatever we want. I also think it is a huge symbol of hatred and division, and the rhetoric of the wall and the building of the actual wall is only fueling bias and hatred towards particularly Mexicans. And honestly, it is already having huge impacts on the biculturalism of our region. Frankly, our people are really proud of on both sides, right? There's like such richness in culture and in language that exists because of how close communities are on the border. Not to mention the economic impacts this wall is going to have between us and our neighbors to the south.
Yeah. And there's also like some First Nations that are split.
That's right.
They were here long before
long
there was
before
a
the
U.S.
Border. Yeah.
Yes. And they're so they have relatives on both sides of what's.
And you heard Kevin say, right, like how many of those federal laws related to Native American communities that are just sort of being pushed aside over and over again. Right. We see this administration mm-hmm. sort of. And many administrations, frankly, right, our immigrant communities have been fighting for liberation for a really long time. And
yeah.
it just happened to get much, much worse this year.
We touched on this a little bit a few minutes ago. Can you talk a little bit more about the militarization at the U.S.-Mexico border and where our senators Udall and Heinrich stand on this?
Sure. So, like I said, in the last 10 years in particularly, we have seen a huge increase in just like harsher and harsher immigration laws. That includes the narrative and not even narrative, but the actual funding of border enforcement. I mean, DHS alone has a gigantic budget, right? And President Trump for this next coming budget fiscal year is requesting even more money. So the budget for specifically border enforcement increased 75% in the last decade.
Wow.
This is bigger than the DEA, FBI, and Secret Service budgets combined.
No kidding.
So our border has never been more enforced and militarized than it is right now. Like Kevin said, Customs and Border Patrol is the largest law enforcement agency in the country,
mm-hmm.
With 22,000 like armed agents, and 18,000 of those, can I give you a guess where they are? On the U.S.-Mexico border, right? And that doesn't even include the type of surveillance and technology that DHS has invested in that, frankly, are used in war tactics, right? Like mm-hmm. those are the kinds of things that you can find on our border community. And when we talk about our senators, Martin Heinrich and Tom Udall, particularly Heinrich has been a huge ally for DACA and for young dreamers, and really going to bat for protecting this. And both of them have been really willing to hear our immigrant communities, and they have done great things, right? And as a community of immigrants, we need them to be better on mm-hmm. things like the militarization of the border. And we need them, particularly our two senators who are representatives of a border state, to be champions for a community and say that the border community does not need any more Border Patrol and ICE agents. We do not need any more immigrant detention beds. We need them to be stronger on pushing back.
Kevin, did you want to add something there?
Yeah, Johanna is absolutely right. I mean, they have been good on some of these issues, both Udall and Heinrich. They've been excellent on the wall. We need people of their stature. We need champions. We need someone in Congress to challenge this false narrative that the border is out of control. Mm-hmm. No wall, but we'll hire more Border Patrol agents. We need someone in Congress telling the rest of the country, because the rest of the country doesn't along the border. They don't understand. Right. It's this myth, and we need someone from the border to stand up and say, no, this is a lie. This is not the way life is.
That's right. And that trade-off, essentially, at the end of the day, that trade-off is our families, right? Mm-hmm. While the wall will absolutely kill wildlife and lands and be this symbol of hate, it is not physically deporting our families, right? Mm-hmm. ICE and Border Patrol deport our families. Detention centers needlessly separate our families and profit off of their, you know, taking away their freedoms. Like, those are the things that are harming our communities the most. So this trade-off essentially becomes the trade-off of our families.
Right. So we're really targeting the most vulnerable people.
That's right.
In our society. So, you know, you guys have given us some numbers and some statistics, and I think those are powerful. But I think even more powerful are stories about people. Stories about ordinary people, people we can imagine as being our own family members and loved ones. So in preparation for this show, I was reading some really heartbreaking deportation articles from the Las Cruces newspaper. Johanna, do you have any stories you can share with our listeners about what's going on in the border communities?
Unfortunately, I have too many.
I know. You could go on for a couple hours, probably.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. I think statistics, I could give you numbers all the time, right? And what executive orders have done and the fear that exists in the communities. And the reality is that we have seen it live and in person in Las Cruces and then Doñana in the last 6 months, right? Since CAFE has been CAFE since 2009, we'd seen two...
And CAFE, again, for our listeners,
Communities in Action and Faith, or Comunidades en Acción y de Fe. We'd seen two deportation cases come through our office since 2009. Since the beginning of the year, we've seen, I was going to say 18, but in the last week, we've had two more. So 20 cases come through our office. And those are the people that are coming to us saying, this happened, can you help us? What can you do? But yeah, I really want to tell you the story of Jorge and Francia and their two sons, Jefferson and Steven. Jorge, Francia, and Jefferson came to this country almost 20 years ago from Colombia, escaping everything that was happening there. And Jorge was a professor, and he was really fearful of his life. And so they came here on an asylum. A couple years after they were here, they'd had their youngest son already. And I will say that immediately when they moved from Colombia, they came to our community. They first lived in El Paso for like six months, and then they came to Las Cruces. Mm-hmm. A few years after applying for asylum, their application was denied, which actually asylum cases are super hard, and all of the burden falls on the person seeking asylum to be able to prove they need it. But anyway, that's a conversation for another day. So from then, they were ordered removed, right? They were told, your asylum application was denied, you need to leave the United States. And at this point, you know, they had roots here already. They had a U.S.-born child, and they decided to stay. For the last 10 years, Francia had worked for the same person as a housekeeper, self-employed housekeeper. Same thing for Jorge. He did computer technician. He's a computer technician and worked from home. Their son Jefferson is a fellow Aggie and graduate of New Mexico State University and got his bachelor's in criminal justice last year. And Steven is a sophomore in high school and is an honor student. And they've been praying at the same church, Our Lady of Health, for the last 20 years. And on May 9th, their entire lives changed. ICE came after them again, because before they were not priorities for deportation. Maybe they had a speeding ticket, you know, in the last 20 years, but nothing else. And Francia and Jefferson were detained. Francia was deported on June 7th back to Colombia. Jefferson was able to apply for DACA. And again, that might not even come through, right? Mm-hmm. And Jorge is actually given hospitality by a Franciscan Catholic community in Las Cruces and is currently seeking sanctuary while his case is being processed. So. Yeah. And I will say, you know, that this was the deportation of Francia. Did that earn an American a job? right? What mm-hmm. what was the purpose behind separating this family besides just separating the family?
Right. Do we all feel safer now?
Right. Right. Exactly.
So we need to take a short break here. So please stay with us. I'm talking about border issues with Kevin Bixby and Joanna Bencomo. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, your host for today's show. And I'm talking with Kevin Bixby and Joanna Bencomo about issues on the U.S.-Mexico border. So Kevin and Joanna are from Las Cruces, which, of course, is a lot closer to the Mexican border than the Silver City is. So I feel like border issues affect you guys in Las Cruces more directly than they do here. So I wanted to ask you, Kevin, when and how did the Southwestern Environmental Center begin its partnership with New Mexico CAFE and the ACLU on border issues?
Probably started working together earlier this year. You know, we could thank President Trump for that. As an organization that works to protect wildlife and their habitats along the in the Southwest along the border, the Southwest Environmental Center was very much involved a decade ago with other conservation groups in fighting the initial construction of the border wall. And we failed. We failed miserably. Mm. And then during Obama's years, it was kind of a dormant issue. The wall was. But then with Trump's election, it's now in the forefront. And we realized we needed partners. We needed to make we needed strength in numbers and working across sectors. So that's when we started working together with ACLU and CAFE and the New Mexico Wildlife Federation, mm-hmm. too.
Okay, good. I mean, it seems like really that a lot of nonprofits are kind of segmented and, you know, like social justice, environmental yeah. issues, and there isn't a lot of crossover, and that really needs to change. So I'd like to ask you the same thing, too, Joanna. What made your group, New Mexico CAFE, decide to work with SWEC?
So we are pretty aligned with our partners at the ACLU. I mean, I wish they were here. They could talk tremendously about militarization of the border.
And we should say that ACLU, Cynthia, what's her last name
Bomba?
Again?
Cynthia
okay.
Bomba.
Sorry,
yeah, she's
remember.
My dear colleague and friend, and shout out to her.
Yeah, we did invite her to be on the show, but she had a scheduling
that's
conflict.
Right, that's right.
So another time.
No, but, you know, honestly, after that first meeting with Kevin and his team and the ACLU and us, it was just so clear that we could no longer do this alone, particularly in our region, right? Like, we're a small community. We just could not do this alone. And honestly, I'm pretty passionate about what I do for so many reasons. And when I hear Kevin and Gabe and their crew talk about what they're passionate about, it meshes, you know, and mm-hmm. I think it's really important for all of us to understand each other's issues and where we're coming from. And I love learning about ocelots and honestly, when I hear Kevin talk about like how diverse our regions are, like, I just think it's beautiful. And again, it's just we don't have a choice anymore.
Right. We don't have a choice anymore. There's some saying I'm probably right. going to crucify it here, but it's something like we have to hang together or we'll hang separately or
yes.
forget exactly how that goes.
Sure.
It's something like that.
Ben Franklin, I can't remember.
Yeah. Okay. So, Kevin, in this last part of the show, I want to ask you about a couple of kind of non-border issues, that things that are happening in Las Cruces. So I understand that there's a proposal to transfer management of the Mesilla Valley Bosque State Park to the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish. What's that all about?
Oh, this one was a surprise to us. SWEC was instrumental in getting that park established. We started working on it in 2000. The park was opened in 2006. We're very proud of that work, and it's a great little park. They don't get the visitors that they should. And now State Parks claims that they don't have the money to operate it, so they're going to give it to another state agency to manage. It will no longer be a state park. They want to give it to Game and Fish. It might be an okay thing, but Game and Fish has a very different mission. They really serve the hunting and angling community, and that's very different than a state park. Mm. So, you know, the community was not consulted, so we're a little bit upset about it. And next Tuesday here in Silver City.
And that date is?
September
5th.
calendars. Next Tuesday, September 5th or 6th, here in Silver City, the Interim Natural Resources and Water Committee from the legislature will be meeting, and this item will be on the agenda. I'll be back in town to be on that.
It is Tuesday, September 5th.
September 5th.
The day after Labor Day.
Here, and I don't know the location, but...
Oh, it's at the Grant County Conference Center on Highway 180.
There you go.
is on the Gila River diversion is on the agenda too. It's a 1.5-day meeting, so we will definitely be there. There'll be a lot of the conservation community will be there. And I also want to ask you, Kevin, first, I want to congratulate you on your new radio station, KTAL in Las Cruces, a community radio station.
Thank
you. Sort of similar to Gila Members Community Radio here, KURU.
Kyle is clapping. And
KTAL.
We are very excited to be on the air. We look to KURU as our, you know, our our inspiration, and you guys have given us a lot of advice as over these past 2.5 years that we've been struggling to get on the air. We're finally on the air.
Good. Where are you on the FM dial?
101.5. We're 101.5. It's low power, so you won't hear us off the air outside of Las Cruces, but we hope to be streaming on the internet shortly, so you'll be able to hear us anywhere in the world.
Good. And what was your role, Kevin?
Quick applied for the construction license. Somebody contacted me I didn't know and said, hey, there's a chance the FCC has opened up a window for low-power FM stations in your community. I encourage you to apply. So I did, and lo and behold, here we are. Now there's a board. It's Las Cruces Community Radio, and I'm just one member on the board, but yeah.
Good. Very good.
We're very excited.
Yeah. Congratulations. We need more of that. We need more community radio
in this
country.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So we only have a few minutes left in the show. So, Joanna, I wanted to ask you, if people are concerned about what you've said on today's show, and I really hope people are concerned.
Me too.
How can they learn more and how can they get involved?
Yeah, I really hope people are concerned and interested to learn more. We've been really working hard to get our like colleagues and peers up north and or at least beyond our border community to really understand that New Mexico is a border state, right? And these things really affect us even if you don't live on the border. I would definitely suggest visit our website, CAFE's website, organizenm.org. But also, and even more importantly, please, please, please call your senators and let them know what you heard here today. Let them know about Jorge and Francia and ask that exact question. Who is safer by deporting this mother? And who really is safer by increasing an already huge, unaccountable agency like Border Patrol and ICE, right? And really tell senators what you're hearing here today from this powerful coalition and your brother and your neighbors to the south, right? Often we hear actually that members of Congress get a ton of calls around the environment, healthcare, jobs, and very little around border issues and immigration issues. So please call your senators, urge them to be champions for our communities, and to make bold statements and take bold action.
Citizens who aren't directly affected by immigration issues just sort of tend to ignore that, not out of any hard-heartedness, but just there's so much to focus on that it's hard to pick an issue.
It is.
But when I saw you at the Progressive Summit in Las Cruces in mid-July, you said something like, we need all of you to call, and that's on you. And
Did I say it that way? Oh, no.
You said, that's on you. But you managed to say it in a way that was just like, you need to take responsibility, but it wasn't offensive.
Okay, good.
So, Kevin, I want to ask you the same question, too. What can people do to get involved in the issues you've been talking about today?
Johanna's... Absolutely spot on. We need to contact our senators. Everybody needs to contact Senator Heinrich and Senator Udall and with the message, none of it, no wall, no boots, no beds.
Right.
Folks can tweet out hashtag no boots, no beds, no wall.
Yep.
What's the order there?
That's right.
Boots, beds, wall.
Yes.
Boots, beds, walls. Okay.
They can go to our website, wildmesquite.org. We also have... Last night at our town hall.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that.
No one
in
town
1 minute.
We had a beautiful event last night that our ACLU Cafe, the Wildlife Federation, and SWEC organized a no wall town hall, community town hall at the border in the loving embrace of many Sunland Park police and Border Patrol agents.
A lot of law enforcement.
But we had a really good turnout. We had about 150 people there. Yeah, we had some great speakers. And it was a great contrast to what was the backdrop for the event. It was a coming together of the community and celebrating our community, not the militarization of it. So we were handing out postcards, which are in the form of a check. And we'll have those on our website for people to sign and send in as well.
Oh, very good. Okay, so that's pretty much it for today's show. So I want to thank you very much, Joanna Bencomo, Kevin Bixby, for joining me on today's show. Thanks to our audio engineer and Kuru Guru, Kyle Johnson. And I also want to thank you, our listeners, for supporting the station and tuning into this week's program. I'm Donna Stevens. Please join us next week for another edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU, at 89.1 FM. This is what community radio looks like.